Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, we are ranking the films of Christopher Nolan in the anticipated Christopher Nolan tier list.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger for thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome to episode number 319 of Real Blend, a podcast that won't try to understand it. We'll just feel it. On this week's show, we are finally going to rank the films of Christopher Nolan. Chrissy Knoll. That's all I call
him. Chrissy Knowles.
Old Chrissy Knowles.
And, friend of the show.
We're going to declare by the end of the... Oh, yeah, without question. We're going to declare by the end of this episode Christopher Nolan's lone masterpiece. So what could possibly go wrong?
I was like, either that or we're all never going to speak to each other again.
Yeah. This could be the end.
Sit here with an interstellar tattoo on my body, so this is going to be a lot of fun.
I mean, that doesn't mean much because he's had some films come out since then.
How imagine would it be if we ended the show on episode 319? Oh. What a random number.
That would hurt. Yeah. Yes, I would not like that at all.
We'll be back for at least one more. We'll be back for at least one more.
Yes, to close things off. Yeah. I'm Sean O'Connell, managing editor at Cinema Blend, joined as always by Jake Hamilton, Kevin McCarthy, and Gabe Kovach. Boys, we have not all been together in the same show in a really long time. Summer's over. We're back to the grind. It's good to see all your smiling faces. How's everyone doing?
Feels like a reunion show, like a cast reunion.
Yeah. we just need the friends couch.
Which is for sale. Dirty laundry. Jake was swamped with the DNC. Hopefully you guys got to see a lot of his coverage. Kev's been doing a ton of interviews. I saw Kev's Beetlejuice stuff. It was tremendous. And
thank you.
And hopefully later on this episode, Kev's going to talk about a couple of films that he highly recommends. We'll leave a little bit of room for that. But in the meantime, we have been promising that we were going to do this tier list. And so in addition to the tier list, we also started to play a fun game where we tried to decide what people's top fives were. And I've had a bunch of ideas of like cool people that we want to do that for. But the tier list, I also enjoy the tier list.
People have been calling for it.
Yeah. It's been for franchises and then rarely we do it for a director. And I think for Nolan, it's been a long time coming. Do you guys remember when Tenet came out and we thought we were going to get Nolan for the first time?
Yeah.
And it was paired with John David and just how panicked we were.
Yeah.
That's the right feeling, right? It was panic.
Yeah. I mean, and it was 15 minutes with John David Washington and Christopher Nolan. So that in itself is tough because we have three hosts on the show and we all want to ask questions. And so how do you balance a 15-minute interview with two people with three hosts?
Right.
And luckily, Christopher Nolan was gracious enough to come back for Oppenheimer. And I love our first conversation with him because if you haven't heard it, people new to the show, we used to end our show with Dunkirk.
Yeah.
And Sean was hilarious enough to ask Nolan to scream it like we do. And he does not have, he was not having it.
Was that from what I recall in the lead up to that, and us talking about how we wanted to handle that, was that the most terrified you were on the show of asking Christopher Nolan?
Strangely, no. I took a lot of joy in trying to shake him out of his comfort zone.
Yeah.
I feel a lot more in the second interview with him. I felt a lot more comfortable for some reason. Yeah. I just felt like his guard was not that his guard is ever up. I think I understand him a little bit more. He's just a different, cat. That's
Kevin,
all.
In the same way, I'm curious if you guys would agree with this, in the same way that it took me time, and I think it takes everyone time to figure out how to interview Harrison Ford, I think it just takes time to figure out how to interview Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, I haven't figured out Harrison Ford yet.
Yeah, Ford took me 5 or 6 times, actually, because I can look back at some of my earlier stuff with him, and it's just, like, cringe. And then I, you know, he's more of a crafts type of actor. But in terms of Nolan, you know, the whole reason we started this show is we wanted to have longer form conversations. And, like, to even have 15 or 20 minutes with Christopher Nolan, 25 minutes with Tarantino, which turns into 2.5 hours down the line, which is wild. But Nolan in particular, like, the fact that he's ever even been on this show is mind blowing to me. Like, and we've all sat down with him, but it is our conversation with him for Oppenheimer is probably next to the 2.5 hour Quentin Tarantino interview we did in New York is the most proud interview I feel as a collective of the show. I remember leaving the Oppenheimer interview and we were all leaving to go to our respective taxis to go to the airport. And we were just like, on cloud nine. And that conversation is really special. If you have a chance to go back, because we're doing the tier list today, just get a sense of like our show. If you're just tuning in, if you're just finding us. But the Oppenheimer interview is awesome. Not to pat ourselves on the back, but it was just a really good conversation. You know,
I was kind of hoping that the tier list that we're going to do today would coincide with. So there's been like rumors bouncing around that Nolan's about to announce the date, like the release date of his next project. Some people are saying it might be like July 2026. I was kind of hoping that would be confirmed before we did this. But anyway, we're going to dive right in without further ado. And I kind of want to know where he's going to land, too. I'm curious what studio is going to take him in.
Well, speaking of that, and like obviously, so the behind the scenes stuff, him and Jordan Peele have been, you know, working on these new, I mean, with IMAX on these new IMAX cameras, because there's a really good video going around the internet right now where they show how loud the 70 millimeter IMAX cameras, 65 millimeter IMAX cameras are. There's a set video from Nope because they sound like lawnmowers. And our buddy Brandon Davis, I'll give him a shout out. He reached out to me. He goes, are they really that loud? I'm like, yeah, that's why. I thought to myself, like, most people probably don't realize the reason why Christopher Nolan goes back and forth with his IMAX to non-IMAX shots is because if you watch a lot of his films, a lot of the heavy dialogue scenes are done in the non-IMAX format, the 65 millimeter film non-IMAX, because those cameras are not as loud as the regular IMAX. So these new ones that Jordan and Chris Nolan and I think Hoyt is involved in it as well, they've developed, I don't know when they're coming out, but my guess, to your point, Sean, is whether or not he's waiting for the release or are they finished? Is he going to shoot the new one on these newer IMAX cameras? Because Jordan announced his, right, which is next year.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's all pending whether or not, you know, with these cameras. That's just a guess. I bet you Nolan, because, I mean, Oppenheimer was back and forth as well, but Oppenheimer was a heavy dialogue film, and Chris Nolan doesn't like doing ADR. And then you have to do ADR if you're shooting with an IMAX camera because it sounds like a lawnmower.
Yeah.
So that's why it's really interesting. Yeah.
Genuinely curious what he's going to do next. I'm curious if it's going to be that horror film that people have sort of,
I hope so,
rumored to have. Yeah. Jake, what would you do in that situation? Nolan horror.
Yeah.
You imagine a 70 millimeter IMAX? I mean, Nope was the closest we've gotten to that. And I can't imagine the immersion.
Did you see Romulus in IMAX?
Yeah, oh, yeah, I saw it in 190.
How was that?
Gorgeous.
Unbelievable. It was one of the things I love about IMAX theaters, particularly the one I went to, is if you sit in a certain space in the theater, the screen is almost over top of your face.
Right.
And I remember just like, because the entire film was 190, and you guys had a great conversation with Fede Alvarez for the film. And, you know, he shot, you know, so if you had the opportunity to see it, it did fill the full 190 IMAX screen, and it was... And I guess people have seen it by this point, but the zero gravity blood shootout sequence looked absolutely insane, man.
I want to get back to a theater and see it.
Yeah, it's cool.
I want to see it in IMAX before it disappears. Anyway, okay, so we're delaying the tier list. We got to get to it. But thank you. First off, if you're watching us on YouTube, hello. Thank you very much. Hit subscribe. Turn on your notifications. Share the show with a friend. If you're listening to an audio needs, go to youtube.com/realblendpodcast to see a video of the show. Of course, available all the different places you get your audio needs met. And if you would like Real Blend Premium, which gets you an ad-free version of the show and the newsletter, check the description on where to sign up. Okay, the Christopher Nolan tier list. I'm going to let Gabe take it over. He's going to be the host of the conversation. And there's some rules, a couple of little stipulations.
Rules. Yeah. This is fun.
Yay.
All right, here we go. Let's launch into our tier list. It's been a while, Gabe, so I will.
Gabe,
yes, sir.
Real quick. Have you told the guys that one of the major rules is that everybody has to answer every question in Bale's Batman voice today?
Getting to that, Kevin.
Did you guys know that?
I was going to lead with that.
I was just going to put that up.
Tier list is not a novel concept. This is something I'm sure a lot of folks at home are familiar with. The way that we do it, though, is we are going to go around. We're going to go in release order of Christopher Nolan's films. And then each of us are going to give sort of where we would put it. We would rank it as an A, as a B, as a C, as a D. If we need to go that low, I'll just, spoilers. And then we'll take the average.
I have a question when you have a time.
Sure. And then we'll take the average of that. For instance, if I say, two of us say A, two of us say C, it would land in B, to just sort of average that out. At the end of it, we get this Frankenstein's monster unrecognizable tier list, and that's very fun. A special thing I want to mention for filmmakers, we've only done this, I think, a couple times. When we're going through, we're only going to rank as high as A. And then at the end, instead of an S tier, we have a masterpiece, and we are going to sort of take the literal sense of a masterpiece, and have to choose amongst the A category, the A tier. We have to discuss and elect our singular masterpiece for Christopher Nolan. Sean, you had a question.
When we are ranking the from A to, let's say, D, are we doing by standards of like a normal movie or standards of of Nolan's movies?
I would say standards of I always think of it as we're talking about movies and this is a movie tier list. And these are right. Christopher Nolan's movies happen to be the category that we're ranking.
Right.
I think if we scale it, it starts to get like it gets a little confusing. People say like you made such and such a D. Is that really a D movie? And we're like, well, it's a D Nolan. Like, I don't know that that's I think
sure.
Well, it's due in the context of.
Yeah, because I don't say that qualifies for like every filmmaker, but it feels like when you're putting, let's say Memento against The Dark Knight, it's like Memento might be an A on anyone else's list kind of thing. But like in comparison is a kind of a B.
Well, do you guys want to scale? What do you guys think? Do you want to scale the list? We can discuss that now.
I mean, I think that's a little unfair to the filmmaker. I think if he has six A's, then he has six A's. I think that's right. I think to make it subjectified, I think is a little unfair
I agree.
His quality of films.
That's perfect. Fine. I agree.
That's fine.
Well, then let's kick any further questions from the jury.
No? No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
A reminder for the folks at home, this is fun. We're doing this for fun. and we'll try to have as much fun as possible.
Right before we just argue for the next 45 minutes.
That said, I do want to hear feedback. These are really fun. Some of the best parts of this are hearing from you all at home and seeing your tier list or what you agree with or what you disagree with. The discussions around these are really what make it worth it. And we're going to kick things off right now with following. Who has an immediate thought? I'll make an admission here. Following is the only movie I actually have not seen of his. I've been meaning to catch up on it, but
Watched it before I interviewed him for Dark Knight Rises, which means that we're talking it like a decade ago.
Sure.
Because I was trying to do a career rewatch before sitting down with him. So if I'm being honest, I don't feel like it can't go in the haven't seen category because I know I have, but I also don't feel like I can give it any kind of a fair judgment.
I think I know that Kevin has seen it more recently. Before I get to everyone else, Jake, just again, this is, for fun and not holding you to anything crazy. Your recollection, do you remember liking it?
Yeah, I remember liking it. I think I was also watching it through the prism of trying to find questions within there that were, as crazy as it sounds, applicable to a third Batman film. Sure. But I definitely remember liking it. So if I were forced to give a knee-jerk reaction, I'd probably say B.
Yeah, I would be at a B with it as well, too. And I haven't seen it in a while as well, too. But to me, it feels like someone's first film. It still feels like a filmmaker who's figuring out his way, trying a bunch of different things.
$6,000 budget.
That's kind of
pound insane. Budget, I guess.
That's kind of insane. I mean, I enjoyed it enough that I would not at least I'm definitely not putting it at a C, but I don't think it quite gets to an A level for me. So I'm going to put it at B.
Kev, have you seen? Is this something you've seen recently?
Oh,
I thought so.
And Chris Nolan was the director of photography on the film too, which is really, really cool. And I want to say he had already met his incredible producing partner, Emma Thomas.
Yeah. She's a producer on it, yeah.
She produced on the film as well. And, you know, just looking at the scale from Following to Oppenheimer to know the work they've collectively made. That was a college film. Jeremy Thielby, I believe, is the lead actor in the film. That film is, I think it's incredible for a first film. I agree with you on a B. The nonlinear nature of the film is remarkable. And a lot of what's cool about watching Following is watching it after seeing his range of work since. And that's why I like watching earlier films from filmmakers after I've watched, you know, years and years of their work in recent time, because then you can see the seeds of that filmmaker's work and kind of what he was dealing with. And like, I see a lot of Inception in Following. I see a lot of just layering of moments in time and the way he plays with time. And obviously when we get to the next film, we're going to talk about all those are applicable as well. So yeah, I would argue a B on Following for sure.
Okay, great. B lands right in there.
Well, this is easy.
I would say least controversial Nolan film, just because it's the most obscure.
Yeah.
You know, after this, it's like, here comes the notoriety. Memento. We're on to Memento, which I would say Memento for me, maybe it's just my generation or any generation that was around this. It hits the mark of a Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, of being like a seminal, I'm interested in movies and how they're made and who made them type of movie. Like, this is like a, oh, it's cool if you know who Christopher Nolan is and you've seen Memento. Mm-hmm. In the way that I think of Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs with Tarantino. Is there anyone that wants to jump off of that with their thoughts and or letter grade?
I remember seeing this with my father. It was in New York, and it was like April, I think it was April 2001. My dad took me to New York to see like a Broadway production of The Producers with Nathan Lane and Matthew Broderick. I remember hearing this film had come out, and I hope I have my time frame right. But I asked my dad to take me to see it. We saw it in Times Square, and obviously back then films were still projected on 35. And I just like you said, the Tarantino-esque nature. You know, not that nonlinear filmmaking hadn't been done before Tarantino, but in that age and time frame, you know, Memento, you could easily compare it to the idea of how Pulp Fiction and, you know, Reservoir Dogs and a lot of Quentin's work was done, the nonlinear storytelling. But the way Memento played with black and white and color, which is obviously very interesting and foreshadowing to what he did on Oppenheimer, the idea of the subjective and the objective point of view. I remember being a big Joe Pantoliano fan at that. You know, he's fantastic in the film.
Best.
Carrie Ann Moss, you know, and that was, what, 2 years after The Matrix, the first Matrix. So
that's right.
You know, any time seeing her after The Matrix was cool.
I think there was 99 and then 2000. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was kind of remarkable. And Guy Pearce, you know, the concept of a tattoo and memory and time. And again, I rewatched this before we did press for Tenet. And again, it was kind of a very different experience, because, you know, going into Memento, I didn't know anything about Nolan until that film. And so my first experience with Chris Nolan is Memento. I remember the DVD for it. Do you guys remember those? Didn't they have like different color paper clips? There was like, I think that was the DVD, like green and blue. Like, you had to find different versions of it at like Best Buy or whatever.
Really? No, I don't remember that at all.
That's interesting. Yeah. But it was an incredible, feature film.
Give a grade. What's your grade?
I'm at an A. No question.
You're an A?
Yeah. I mean, that movie is remarkable. It plays with time brilliantly. And like I said, with Oppenheimer, it's that original, that idea of playing with color and black and white in a way that was point of view based, which I thought was cool.
Jake, where are you?
We're going to be here for 4 days, aren't we?
No, not at all.
No, I'm an A as well. If only because, I mean, the whole point of a movie is to make you feel what a character is feeling. And the fact that Nolan is able to structure this movie to make us understand what it means to have the exact same symptoms that Guy Pearce's character does. Like him, we don't know what just happened because we're experiencing the story backward. And so it allows us to relate to him in a level that most of us never could, because we're experiencing a thing and, like him, confused because we don't get what just happened that led to that thing. So to be able to not just, you know, follow what's going on with this character who's experiencing this incredible, you know, moment in life, but to almost be able to step for step go, dude, I'm right there with you, man. I also don't know what the hell is going on. Mm-hmm. And then every step of the way sort of progressively work backward. It's a really amazing experience of filmmaking. So yeah, I'm A as well.
Sean?
Yeah, it's an A. And I hate to do it so early in his career, but it's an A. This is a little
I didn't want to do the subjective thing because I felt like we would have slided Memento. So this probably might have been a B.
Yeah, or something like that. Yeah,
maybe, but that's right. Yeah. So it is important to kind of mention, and Kev was saying this, that when this came out, well, Gabe even started saying it, like people were clamoring for big voices in independent cinema. This was, you know, this was after the rush of Reservoir Dogs and Clerks, and this was a huge Sundance title, and people just wanted to feel cool, like they knew some new, you know, voice in the independent film community. But within that, he, you know, Nolan drops this airtight kind of, you know, twisty murder mystery thriller that introduces essentially Guy Pearce, you know, but also leans on an incredible Joe Pantoliano performance. He's just great in it. And the script is so great. And it, again, starts to indicate the way that Nolan's going to play with manipulation of time. And we're going to, you know, talk about that in a lot of his films. But it comes in such a tight package. It's such a concise, tight, intriguing, like a bold premise that if anyone else had come with it, you'd be like, get out of here. What are you trying to do?
Yeah.
You know, tell this whole thing in reverse. And a guy who tattoos these clues to himself on his body.
So. Yeah. And Jake brings up a great point about the audience. We are. Yeah. And like, there's, to me, the beauty of filmmaking is when the audience is with the character in that way. And I think through the way Nolan tells the film, to Jake's point, we are just as confused as him, which is kind of a weirdly comforting thing, but also simultaneously frustrating. But that's kind of the beauty of where the film lies, is in that middle ground of those two feelings. That's why the film works so well.
Well, we had a long intro to this episode, so we are going to take a break right now. And on the other side, we're going to pick back up with Insomnia. So we'll be right back.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we're back, and we're diving right back in with the third film on this list, Insomnia. Jake, Sean, Kev, who wants to start us off with Insomnia?
I'll be quick. You want me to be quick?
Go ahead.
I'm giving this an A. I rewatched it before Oppenheimer. I did not love it originally when it first came out. I liked it.
Did you lose any sleep over that?
Yeah, but I think the difference is that this is a remake. Which I think this is his only remake, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And I think it's like the effect of Pulp Fiction to Jackie Brown and then Boogie Nights to Magnolia, where I now appreciate Jackie Brown and Magnolia much more. But following the height of those films, like Memento was such a huge deal that Insomnia just felt a little more cold and nuanced in that way. It wasn't until later in life that I could appreciate it. Robin Williams is brilliant. You know, Al Pacino is brilliant. Hilary Swank is amazing. So I'm at an A. I love this film. But if you had asked me this question 15 years ago or whatever it was, I would have been like, yeah, it's fine.
All right. I'm going to get spicy then.
Go ahead.
Because I think it's a C.
Oh, wow.
And I say that it's a C just because even by normal movie standards, it's just a basic thriller. It has one gimmick, which is the absence of darkness. It's, you know, perpetual sunlight, and it's affecting the mood of a detective. And I think the performances are good. I'm not saying that it's bad, but I don't think it ever really elevates itself beyond just being a standard thriller that if you had showed it to me and then asked me, did Christopher Nolan direct this? I would have said, no, there's not a single chance. Like, I don't think it has any real signature of Nolan.
He didn't write it either, right?
I don't think so, because it's just a remake of a European film.
But I'm saying I don't think he wrote the script for this film either. I think he did Memento, got hot as a director, and then studio was making this film. It was written by somebody already, and he got attached. That's what probably. I think
yeah.
happened.
Yes, probably. Yes, he yeah. did not write this. Yeah, and it's the only one that feels like he didn't write it on his
yeah.
filmography.
Yeah, well, that's going to be sort of why I'm going to split the difference and give it a B, because I think I agree with Sean in that, like, it's a standard thriller. I think it's a good standard thriller.
Yeah,
but I would argue, looking at sort of all of the little thumbnails of all of his films, it's the one where if another filmmaker had stepped behind the camera to direct, I think it could have been the exact same movie.
You
I think
get
it
basically could have been the same
fine.
Thing.
Yeah. Every other movie I'm looking at, and I'm thinking that movie would have been lesser had someone else directed. I think a lot of people, probably respectfully to Christopher Nolan, I think a lot of people could have directed Insomnia.
I mean, give me Fincher's Insomnia.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. That's a good point. So
I would,
to Jake's I'll, point, I'm going to go to a B actually. Now that I'm thinking about it in the scale of things, I think you guys convinced me that it's not an A.
I was going to lock us in and say a B as well. But this is, I will say, this is one, this and probably The Prestige are ones that I haven't rewatched in a long time. Like, these are like, I'd love to get that. So I was curious.
Prestige for sure. Well, we'll talk about Prestige in a second.
Sure. Yeah, we're about to get there. But this is one where I'm like, I am curious on a rewatch now how I've changed, how my, you know, perception of whatever a Nolan movie is. I'm curious how it plays, but I think that locks us in at B. And then we get to Batman Begins.
All right.
You might say Christopher Nolan Begins for most of the population.
I'm going to put it at an A. I'm prepared for you guys to disagree with me, but let me explain to you why I think that this is an A and why I'll be the one on the show who says that I prefer this to The Dark Knight. As crazy as that sounds. I had never prior to this point seen a Batman film and even just Batman stories. There are so many Batman stories and Batman films that go from his parents were murdered to now he's a crime fighter. Mm. And the fact that this movie spends an hour showing you how he got there, like the training that he had to go through, the setting up Ra's al Ghul, Ra's al Ghul, and they're pronounced multiple ways. To then come back around and become the threat that's terrifying Gotham, to take you step by step to show like how he got the Batmobile, how he figured out through Lucius Fox, you know, that he can use the Wayne Corporation to bring in all of this equipment, to paint the suit, to do the batarangs, to do all, like, it was like I had never seen someone stop and take the time to fill in the cracks of the mythology. And I fucking loved it. I was like drunk on seeing somebody take the time to set up that entire foundation of who Batman was. I don't think Bale goes so far into the voice in
he
the
doesn't.
First one. So it's funny to see that kind of evolve down the Gravelly Road. And weirdly enough, I like Katie Holmes more than Maggie Gyllenhaal in the part.
I do. I agree with you about that.
I think
Rachel's death scene in The Dark Knight would have been far more, not that it wasn't powerful, but I think it would have been far more powerful if it had been Katie Holmes.
Katie Holmes. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. So for this reason, it's an A. And now I don't know if the other, I'm curious what the other guys.
I'll jump in because I agree. It's an A for me for all the reasons you said. I think that it has to get credit for kind of being the first of its kind. Like, I think with what followed And then with what Zack Snyder kind of picked up the mantle of the DC sort of universe and turned it into with sort of the realism and hyperviolence and all of that. Like, from my perspective, and I was very young when this came out, this was like, oh, these can be real. Like, these can be realistic and gritty and grounded. And that became a cliche and kind of like people became exhausted with the quote unquote grounded superhero movie. But this movie did it, and it did it really well. And it, and I think it sort of introduced a whole audience to not only Batman, but just what that type of movie could be. And I would even argue, and I'll leave this dangling for when we get to The Dark Knight, I think regardless of how much mythology and sort of context that the Batman character has in pop culture, I don't think The Dark Knight gets to do what it does without The Batman Begins. I know that sounds kind of obvious of like it's the first movie, but I think because of the world that it sets up and the character that it sets up, The Dark Knight gets to just blossom into this amazing film.
What's interesting about that point, though, is I would liken Batman Begins and Dark Knight to Terminator 1 and Terminator 2.
I think that's fair.
Like, what I mean by that is, though, is that Dark Knight works completely singularly without Batman Begins. Mm-hmm. But to your point, the watching of T1 would enhance T2. But so I saw Terminator 2 before I ever saw T1. When I saw The Dark Knight, I had only seen Batman Begins one time, and I barely remembered it.
Wow.
And my Dark Knight experience, I would even argue, was kind of, because I saw Batman Begins at a word of mouth radio screening
on an iPod.
I thought it was amazing. But so my Dark Knight experience, I would even say, was almost voided of the Batman Begins experience. And obviously, we'll get to that shortly. But
sure. Where would you put Batman Begins? Just go ahead and pick it up. I said A as well.
I'm going to go B because, you know, not that I'm dealing with the looking at the films here and thinking about it, but there are things about Batman Begins that I don't love. I do think it's a little bit on the slower side at times. I do like the world building, and I do think Katie Holmes is better in the part. I do agree with that 100%. I mean, Batman Begins was the first time we ever heard that Zimmer theme. Oh, so yeah. that piece of music.
Well, and remember how amazing Oldman is? Like, Oldman's perfectly cast as Jim
Gordon. Yeah. Oldman's
perfectly cast. Yeah. Michael Caine's perfect. Michael Caine is fantastic. So
Morgan Freeman
is the best casting in Nolan's Batman. Is it even Bruce Wayne, or is it
I think it's Ledger.
Ledger.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. Okay. Taking Ledger out of it, because that's like an anomaly of film. Who's the best cast character?
Gary Oldman.
It's probably Oldman.
I also would put Michael Caine up there.
Michael Caine.
Yeah. Also, Alfred. Eckhart is. Well, I guess Eckhart only is in two, but
he's great though. Yeah, he is really good.
What a performance!
Perfect Two-Face. No, he's and that's not to put
Tommy Lee Jones,
the Batman Bruce Wayne dual cast. I think he's one of maybe my favorite Batman. I think he's fantastic. But
see, I think I love his Bruce Wayne.
Yes,
I don't love his Batman.
I think Affleck is a better Batman than Bale, but I think Bale's a better Bruce Wayne.
I think they're just different. In my mind, I view them as different. The voice stuff never really bothered me that much. Fine. You know, like, it's overblown in my opinion, but...
Jake, I want to jump in on the comment about I'm going A, and Batman Begins is a top 10 superhero movie of all time.
Okay.
And I think a big part of that comes from the fact that I think, and it's not to take away from any of the other Batman movies that preceded it, because one of my all-time favorites is Batman Returns. But I do think it's the first time a filmmaker behind the camera on a Batman movie was just as interested in Bruce Wayne as he was Batman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really easy to get excited about Batman and want to like throw everything into those scenes because it's a really fun toy to play with. Mm-hmm. It's less sexy and less exciting to give your all for Bruce Wayne. And I feel like that's what Nolan does, because he understands that the scenes with Batman don't hit as hard if you don't give a damn about who Bruce Wayne is. So to your point, Sean, spending that hour setting up how that transition was made, that whole scene doesn't just make Batman, or that whole hour doesn't just make Batman Begins better. It makes the entire trilogy better. Whenever we come back around years later and, you know, and Alfred says, you know, why do we fall? That line only lands because we were given that hour of buildup 8 years prior. So
Jake, I think he says, why do we follow Master Wayne? I think he says
exactly. So I'm sorry.
That's really
Forgive me. That was damn good.
That was really good.
I just pictured Gabe like in front of a mirror for the last week knowing we were going to do this tier segment. He was like, that line's going to come up. That line's going to come up.
I do want us to keep the pace going, but because you mentioned top 10 superhero movies, I'll ask one more question in the sense of giving this its flowers. Do we get Logan if we don't get Batman Begins?
No,
like I think there's a whole
conversation about what of superhero movies we get, period.
Well, no, you guys have to, I don't know, you guys probably don't remember that the transition prior to Batman Begins was that superhero movies were sold toys and Happy Meals.
Yeah. And that was around like the Fox era. That was like the end of, not the end, but like that was sort of, you know, in the years we'd gotten a few of like the movies X-Men that Deadpool and Wolverine pay tribute to.
Sure.
This was sort of the antithesis to that.
This movie whiffs.
Yeah.
We don't go in the direction that we're in now at all. Yeah. We've run back to animated, you know, live action animated superhero films.
I do think I mean, weirdly enough, I wouldn't call this grounded because it deals with vampires, but the first Blade, you know, deserves more credit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it deserves more credit for many reasons. One, it broke the mold in terms of like with R rating, you know, in a Marvel film, you know, everyone looks at the first Deadpool. But I agree with the point about, you know, do we get Logan without Batman Begins? But I think Deadpool is more responsible for Logan than anything else because of the R rating. Because with Deadpool's success,
I think you're right in that a studio is more comfortable to produce an R-rated version of Logan. But I think that not only from the studio's perspective, but from sort of priming an audience, I think that Batman Begins and Chris Nolan's sort of trilogy set the stage for an audience that wants that type of story told. Like to Sean's point of like, I even think the MCU owes some credit to allowing for Batman Begins and The Dark Knight and stuff, allowing for superhero movies to sort of be that ground level human story.
Absolutely.
And not just like you're saying, that sort of animated realm.
To the point where like in the midst of that, Bryan Singer came back with Superman Returns and it was such a throwback to the earlier superhero ones that audiences kind of rejected it. They were like, no, we don't want this anymore. This is done.
Well, let's keep trudging. We have some staples coming up and maybe we'll try to pick up the pace to get to the masterpiece conversation. But let's move on with The Prestige. Who wants to start off The Prestige?
It's an A. And Prestige is an A.
Prestige is an A?
Yeah.
It's an A.
To me, it's airtight, flawless, incredible performances, tremendous premise, great screenplay, looks amazing. It's an A.
And I agree. There's the biggest reason why I think The Prestige is an A was because it combines the two elements that I feel like are that I love in life: filmmaking and magic. And filmmakers are magicians, and movies are magic tricks and illusions that we buy into as audience members. And to make a film about magic, but then pull a trick on the audience and twists and turns at the same time, it's just, to me, it's the combination of why I love cinema so much. And I think that film, like you said, Sean, is airtight. It's brilliant.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it's an A for me as well. It almost it's an interesting counterpoint to Insomnia in that, like, with Insomnia, my argument was you put a different director behind there, you know, it's probably would have been the exact same movie. The Prestige is as crazy as it sounds, considering how complicated it ends up being, I think a little bit on the more simpler side of his filmography.
It is.
But another filmmaker still could not have. I mean, it is as good as it is because of the skills of Christopher Nolan behind. Yeah. And what I really also appreciate is also keep in mind, you know, we're obviously going in the order in which he made things. These little palate cleansers he gave himself between the Batman films, I think were really important for him to not get burnt out on Gotham City. Sort of allowing himself to just take a break from Batman.
I also love that he did The Prestige and then he wrote the Joker magic trick scene in The Dark Knight. Like I love that kind of bleeds in. It's fun.
It's insane to me to think, like, I'm just sitting here looking at The Prestige poster. I forget how insane Hugh Jackman's filmography is.
Oh, it's great.
Like, yeah. Like, he should have like, more than one Oscar nomination.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about a guy like, I think The Fountain is one of the best movies ever made. It's Aronofsky. Sure. I mean, like, he has, Hugh Jackman truly
can do anything.
Yeah, he's such an amazing actor that I forget he worked with Nolan.
Yeah.
I forget he was in a Chris Nolan film.
Yeah.
It's wild to me.
He belongs in a Spielberg film at some point. I'm surprised that the two of them have worked together. Yeah. That's really funny. I want to just go back to what Jake just said. I consider the Batman films to be palate cleansers between the types of movies that Nolan really wants to make.
Yeah.
And interesting. I guess these other movies are palate cleansers.
Yeah, because The Dark Knight only happens. I mean, sorry, Inception only happens with Dark Knight's success.
And I mean, you could, you know, I think there's a really solid argument that like the Dark Knight films, the trilogy, is where the average movie going public started figuring out who this guy was.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he knew. Even if, and I'm not saying that they are, but even if they weren't the movies he wanted to make or the way he wanted to spend his career, he knew he had to knock these out of the park because the success and the quality of this trilogy, I think, is the determining factor that allowed him to make something like a Dunkirk or an Interstellar or Tenet. I mean, you're talking about if we don't get that instead of this, I don't think we get Dunkirk, Interstellar, Tenet, and Oppenheimer if he doesn't crush the Dark Knight trilogy the way he did.
Sure. Yeah.
And let me ask a quick question.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I think the palate cleanser perspective also is not that The Prestige and Inception are small movies by any means, but the palate cleanser for him as a filmmaker to go from the machine of working with an IP and having, you know, all those conversations you have to have and decisions have to be made around a character and the way they're represented versus an original thing that you can kind of make your own and just come in and, you know, at budget.
That's my point. So that end, if his next project were to be a Bond movie or a mission movie, let's say, would you guys be disappointed?
Following Oppenheimer, you mean next?
Yes.
I want something original.
I mean, to be fair, though, are you at this stage? I'd have to see the movie, obviously, but like I'm excited for whatever Christopher Nolan decides he wants to make next. Like no one's making him do anything.
Tenet is his Bond movie, right? Like
he considers
Tenet to be his
See, it's funny. I feel like the last act of Inception is his Bond movie.
Yeah,
or probably at least his taking a shot at a Bond action sequence.
You know, the
snowmobiles through the mountains and everything.
Yeah. Okay. 100%. I'm just curious if he comes out and says he was doing a franchise next. Like,
I'd be fine with that. I think when he does a franchise.
I just don't want to see him play by someone else's rules.
Which is why I don't think he'll ever do a Bond movie, because there's too many stipulations.
And I think that's my point. If he hopped onto a franchise film, I think he would hop. I think he's already done The Dark Knight, and there's no world where someone comes with a franchise and he doesn't say, I get final cut and complete creative control, or you can find someone. Like, I think he has that power.
Did you guys see the breaking news before the show? The Russo brothers have left Secret Wars and Nolan is stepping in.
Oh.
Did you guys see that?
That was the secret the whole time.
Downey convinced him to come over.
Dr. Doom is actually based off of Strauss from Oppenheimer.
But honestly, but that's a good point. Like, if let's say Downey was like, I have an idea for a Marvel thing and I want, and Nolan would be interested in doing it. You think Kevin Feige in any world wouldn't say, Christopher Nolan, do whatever the hell you want. I'll figure out how to make it work.
He'd say blank check.
I'll
see you at the premiere.
Please don't ruin my career.
This is why I argue that Christopher Nolan is one of the biggest stars in Hollywood.
For sure.
Like not even just like from an actor or director perspective, that name sells tickets.
I used to push back on you on that, but I can't anymore.
No, Oppenheimer like nailed that now.
Yeah.
It did everything, which we'll get to. Let's go ahead and throw to another quick break, and then on the other side we'll pick up The Dark Knight and speed our way through to this masterpiece conversation. But this has been fun. Stay tuned, we'll be right back. All right, we are back. We're picking up with The Dark Knight. I think that this, I mean, I'm just gonna say that I think we're A's across the board.
The D.
Anybody want to give it a
I mean, it's, for Dark Knight.
I think it's the greatest superhero movie ever made.
I was going to say, you could say it is the masterpiece of its own genre if you
let's
wanted
not,
to.
Yeah. Like it. Let's. No. No. But yes, it's an A.
It is definitely everything you guys just said. But also, one thing I'll say about it is, like, this was the first time we had seen a filmmaker use those IMAX cameras that were used for science documentaries and feature storytelling. Mm. And to me, that is the most game changing moment I've ever had as an audience member from an immersion perspective, from storytelling, to see something that large in feature filmmaking. And I know that he did some tests, like he said in our interview, right? I think on Prestige with some of the cameras, mm-hmm. I want to say.
I think it was just even like inserts, wasn't it? Like it was like small inserts. Stuff.
Yeah, but this film, to your point though earlier about Batman Begins being grounded, this even more so. Sure. Because like the Scarecrow stuff in Batman Begins, you know, that's obviously superhero-esque and fine. Yeah. But in Dark
still
Knight,
still grounded in sort of like a chemical, you know, true. Bioweapon type.
Right. Thing. But I think in Dark Knight, you buy in grounded-wise, like why
it's a crime thriller.
It's heat. It's heat. Mm-hmm, and that to me was why it was so groundbreaking. Dark Knight did exactly what you guys were saying about Batman Begins did, but I think on a whole different level.
And again, like I was saying, well, you know, talking with Batman Begins of like allowing it to, that's what I think Batman Begins did, is it set the stage for The Dark Knight to be extremely grounded versus if he came in and he made, hey, it's a crime thriller, but there's a Batman.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. I think it stands on its own, but I think Batman Begins really like gave the runway for him to craft that world exactly.
Yeah.
Like. I've been thinking about this a lot lately. I might even write a piece about this on Cinema Blend. The one thing that this movie has done that I hold against it is that no one has done a traditional Batman and Joker movie since.
Mm.
The Joker has not been featured in a major Batman movie since.
Why do you hold against it?
Because I want a good Batman Joker movie. There's 20 amazing Joker Batman stories that they could keep doing. No, because even in this movie, they get one scene together. They essentially get the interrogation scene.
The whole movie is there back and forth.
I want a Joker Batman movie.
I see what Sean's talking about. You're talking about those scenes where they're playing off each other and that.
Yeah.
I imagine.
Jared Leto was assigned to the Suicide Squad. When he finally got into Snyder's movie, it was a after credit scene set in an alternate, you know, future. Barry Keoghan has been teased in Matt Reeves's.
Do you think he's going to be in the next one though?
I really hope they use him as like a Hannibal Lecter type. I think it'd be really cool if through Pattinson's Batman trilogy, if they kept him in Arkham, kept him behind a wall of glass, and Batman has to keep coming back to him.
See, but that's all anybody uses him for.
But we've seen so much. I want another take on Mr. Freeze.
I'll take Mr. Freeze. Right. I just want a Batman Joker story.
I think it's a good point.
You got one, goddamn.
Sean, I'm assigning you that article, even though I don't have I'm assigning you that article. Write that up. That's a good
one. What if Matt Reeves brings Arnold back and just uses him for reinvents?
I would pay so much money to see Arnold come back as Mr. Freeze.
In Matt Reeves's
I used to have a Mr. Freeze action figure. That's how obsessed I was with Arnold.
The best.
Inception. Inception. Let's go ahead and move on to Inception.
I think Inception is the most Christopher Nolan movie. If like someone, I know we used to play this game, if an alien showed up, but it's got to be comprehensible. I think Inception. If my parents came to me and said, I don't know who Christopher Nolan is, like pick us a movie to explain his appeal. I would say watch Inception.
And to your point, that it's like even people mimic the sounds of
it's a big deal.
I remember Inception ending and sitting next to a friend of mine going, can they just start that again right now?
And the conversation on the way home.
So is that two A's? Is that two A's I take?
So you're both A's.
No question.
All right. Inception's a B for me. Inception is where I start to say to you guys that I think Nolan's head is too far up his own ass.
Come on. That's insanity. That's insanity.
What Sean is saying is he doesn't like original filmmaking.
It's coming for Best Picture, man. That movie's incredible.
There's too much heavy lifting in Inception. It's all there and it all fits together the way you want it to, but you have to it's homework.
You gotta work.
It's a healthy dose of homework.
That's good. That's immersion. My only slight on Inception is I think I've said this before.
It's too clever.
No, I actually think it's a little too cold.
Okay.
Because one of the complaints that people have on Nolan's films is that they're too cold. There's a scene in Inception that I think, and I've said this before, if they had extended it by 3 seconds, I think the film would have hit much differently.
It's the scene where the top fell.
Well, no, it's the Marion Cotillard, the Marion Cotillard death scene.
Okay.
And DiCaprio, in my opinion, is one of the greatest criers as an actor. And like, I always think of the scene in Shutter Island when he's holding his kids in the water. It's like, there's something about the way he cries. Jesus. And Chris Nolan just cuts away from him so fast after she falls. And I just think like we needed like 3 more seconds of that beat so that we could have felt that, because then that would have made the ending hit harder. But it's such a persnickety comment. It's so small in detail. That film is so beyond that. That's my only complaint about Inception, is it's a little too cold and I wanted a little more warmth.
To me, Inception is, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should. And I think Nolan proves that he can tell a story like this, twists and turns and going another layer deeper and another layer deeper, doesn't mean you should.
How many times have you seen it?
Oh, a dozen times.
He's still watching it, Kev. That's the secret. that is an A. I also was putting that in A's. Three A's to one B.
Okay.
The Dark Knight Rises. I'm curious if this is going to be
C.
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 Wow.
C.
Jesus.
C.
Jake, Christ. What were you thinking? Because I was B leaning C.
I'm B. I'm a strong B. I think, is it flawed? Yes, of course it's flawed. But I also think that there are some momentous sequences in Dark Knight Rises that are awe-inspiring that you guys are sleeping on. I mean, there are truly...
I do sleep on this movie a little bit. The fight
in the sewer, you know, where he breaks Batman's back, the climb out the prison, you know, the fight in a snowy Gotham on Wall Street.
Yeah, like, but it ends with a ticking time bomb clock that's out of the 1960s.
Ticking time bomb right now, man.
The Bane Batman fight is remarkable.
Sure, like, it's really good.
This is so stupid. Right out of the comics. This is me being stupid and overthinking. I always thought the ticking time bomb was like a tip of the cap and a love letter to the old Adam West Batman.
Maybe
if that's the case, it didn't work
because of that famous scene where he's like Batman's running with the bomb. You know?
Yeah, no, I know.
Have you guys seen the interview with Hardy where he's talking about figuring out the Bane voice?
Yes, yeah. It's like an old wrestler,
It's old boxer. And my favorite thing, if you have, Sean, it doesn't sound like you've seen it. It's great. It's a great quote. It's Tom Hardy tells a great story. And he's talking about taking this person's voice and wanting to do that. And he goes to Nolan. He goes, we could do this. He goes, I think this is interesting. He's like, you know, maybe we'll get laughed at. I said, or we could go the sort of Vader, you know, straight kind of villain voice. And he's like, and we have the sort of history of the character to kind of consider. The lineage of the character. He's like, but if we do this, you know, I think it could be fun, or we just get laughed at. And he goes, and he just said, yep, nope, sounds great. And he goes, and now everyone laughs at it.
I think it's great. I love the voice.
I think it's great. See, but it was a meme.
I distinctly remember going to go see the IMAX preview, which was the airplane sequence.
Yeah. Prologue. Yeah.
And thinking, like, I don't understand a single word.
But it fixed it.
Yeah. I had to go back and fix it. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's a B.
Yeah. Here's the thing about Rises.
I can't believe we're going to have a C. No,
that's not going to get. I have it in B. Wait. And the way that this works is if it's high, we always go for the higher tier because this is fun and we're not trying to take.
I just want to say it does not. It's the only movie in Nolan's filmography that I feel like he had to make because of the success of the franchise.
Sure.
I don't think he was compelled to make it.
I think before Ledger passed, I think he had a plan.
That's interesting.
I think Dark Knight Rises, I don't think it was that he was forced to make it. Right. I think it's not the movie he wanted to make.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think that's fair.
Yeah.
I think that's a huge what if.
I tried to get him to talk about it at Dark Knight Rises and he wouldn't do it. I tried getting him to say what was the plan. I think Bane would have been involved. I think Bane would have broken the Joker out of Arkham, and that it would have been, and then Batman would have had two different villains on two different levels, an intellectual level and a physical level.
Do you think it would have been like Joker instead of the Ra's al Ghul stuff that's in Rises? Maybe. Well, let's keep chugging along. We reach our previous namesake, Dunkirk. I mean, Dunkirk's amazing. It's an A. Does anybody else disagree? Everyone, how do you guys feel?
It's a B for me.
Really?
And I only say that because I get no joy in rewatching it. I respect the hell out of it, but it's not fun for me to watch.
I agree, it's the one that for me feels
the most like homework. And it's just like
interesting.
If I had to sit down and rewatch his entire filmography start to finish, that would be the one that when I got to, I would have to go, okay, let's do it. And again, it's not to take away from the craftsmanship of it. Like, if the man had won Best Director for it, I wouldn't knock it. I don't enjoy watching Dunkirk.
I'm going to put it in that it lacks the kind of like, there is time manipulation, and I understand the time manipulation in it. But it's not used to like a wondrous way.
It's more, I think it's more traditional.
It's like, pretty meat and potatoes. Yeah. It's pretty meat and potatoes, which is fine. But to me, it's, I'm going to put it at a B because of the, like, not to compare it to the other films because we're not supposed to do that. But to me, it's a rock solid B.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree.
Kev, you haven't said where you're at.
It's an A plus for me. It's like, I think the brilliance of Dunkirk is the relentless nature of the intensity of it. It is an hour and 40 minutes. And I loved the concept of Nolan. You know, a lot of World War II films are known to be long. I mean, and I think storytelling wise with Dunkirk, you don't really get to know really any of the characters too well. You are more in the experience of what happened, and the time manipulation with the 1 week on the beach, the 1 day on the boat, and the 1 hour in the air, I think encapsulates the intensity of what that felt like from an overview perspective of that moment. And the movie is about surviving, not winning, right? At least that's the way I think about it. Like, I think that these characters are trying to survive. And I think when the moment hits, when all the, I mean, first of all, this is a story I didn't know about much. I mean, I had heard of Dunkirk, but it's such a story that I wasn't too familiar with. But the idea of people taking their own boats to come help these soldiers, and the way that music hits as they all arrive at the moment where everyone thinks they're all going to die is just incredible. I also think Kenneth Branagh delivers some of his best work in this film. I mean, while there's a minimal dialogue, it's all about facial expressions. I thought Dunkirk was an absolutely remarkable experience, and I feel honored that I've seen it.
That puts it, I did actually mix up, these got mixed up. So Interstellar was before Dunkirk. We still have Interstellar to do. So sort of backtracking in release order, we're going to jump to Interstellar. Interstellar, I think
I'll let you guys go.
Jake, you start us. Where are you at with Interstellar? Because I feel like it's a very
strong, solid A. I think it was an awe-inspiring experience. I don't think I care for it the way that Kevin does, but it's not I don't mean that in like in a dismissive way about the movie. But it's a pretty remarkable achievement, and I love watching it. I'm in awe of the different sequences, and I think there are a handful of sequences in that movie that that if any director like had been behind the camera for this, that'd be the best thing they'd ever done. And for Nolan, it's just like, that's some of his really good stuff.
Yeah, I'm an A as well. Sure. I think it's a solid A film. Kev, I'll go to Kev because I think you're in line with us. You're an A.
I'll just say A. And to Jake's point, I think. In the history of all cinema, I think the McConaughey sequence deserves to be talked about as one of the greatest scenes ever made. I think that there's nothing more, and I'm not even a parent, and I'm surprised Sean doesn't love this film because the whole film is about parenting. And like, Sean, I struggle sometimes to think about you not loving Interstellar as much as I do, because I just imagine like if you were sitting in McConaughey's seat and PJ and Brendan had grown up for 23 years and you missed it all, but it was only 4 hours of your life, and you're watching them grow up and go through, you know, their school and having kids and getting married. And I just think to myself, like, that is one of the most devastating and interesting ways to look at time. And the emotion on McConaughey's face, and I'm not saying a scene should make you love an entire film,
sure,
but I do find the journey of that to be so interesting, and him getting back at the end to Ellen Burstyn, who's over 100 years old at that time, and being the same, basically the same age, sure, and same looking as he was, and essentially leaving his daughter's deathbed as she and her entire family that he's missed. I just find that to be so mind-blowing.
Sean, go ahead and jump in so we can keep going. Your thoughts?
My biggest knock on is all those things that you described, the movie, to me, doesn't earn any of it.
Interesting.
To me, when you called, what did you call earlier? I think it was Inception as being cold.
Yeah.
Interstellar to me is ice cold.
Really? I think it's his most warm film.
It is ice cold. It is so frigid. It is impenetrable for
warmest?
Me. I have tried so many times to watch this movie and I just bounced right
where
off.
Where would you grade wise?
C.
You put it at C?
C. Yeah,
I'd put it at C.
That's three A's Jonathan. To one C. I don't think drops it to
might
two
be my
B.
least favorite movie of his.
Wow.
See, that's Dark Knight Rises for me.
I'd watch Rises 100 times over.
What?
How do you guys feel about that? I'm firmly in an A. I think we're all firmly in an A. I think three A's to one C still puts it in A, right?
That's fine. That's fine. Yeah, I know I'm going to lose that fight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I just don't want it in the masterpiece. I'll fight that.
Okay. I'll start with Tenet and just say that for me, Tenet is an A. I loved that movie. I think it became a meme and like it's like hard to understand or whatever. I think that it's actually, it's hard to say this without it sounding like you just got to pay attention. But like, I think if you're really watching the movie and maybe watch it twice, but great movies are often really great.
Third
the
act
time
is
around.
Really batshit though. I mean,
it's absolutely insane,
but it's amazing. Like it's amazing. Like when you get to the end and you find out that they've been partners and he's just at the other end of the timeline is the coolest fucking thing ever.
I cry every time, man.
It really is.
James Bond could never get away with something that cool.
Yeah, I agree. It's weird for me to not love Inception, but to love Tenet.
Yeah, this is way more insane than Inception. This is like Inception on steroids.
For some reason, this one feels maybe Inception had to walk so this could run. I guess.
I'm firmly in A. Sean, where are you?
I am also in an A. I think John David Washington is also a great Christopher Nolan lead that probably doesn't get enough credit. Like people go to how much he worked with DiCaprio, but I think him and John David Washington did something really special with him. I fucking love it.
Jake?
I'm going to give it a high B.
Okay.
And I only say that again because I in the same way that I sort of spoke about Dunkirk, I do agree with the idea of just sort of watching it and going with it. I do think it does deserve some faults. I think it makes sense for the most part, but I also think you have to, the fact that I had to put on subtitles and rewatch it a couple of times. I do think,
but
that
I would argue that everything that you need to know is in the movie though.
Yes.
Like there are so many films that like, you know, we talk about superhero stuff, Star Wars stuff, all this stuff is like, well, did you watch the TV show did you watch this?
Sure,
do you know that?
Sure, but and okay, everything but based on my theatrical experience, I strongly disagree because you know what I didn't have the first time I watched it? Audio clarity. The fact that I had to put on subtitles to understand.
I genuinely
could not understand what they were saying the first time I watched this movie. I cannot honestly tell you I walked out. I cannot tell you that I walked out the first time. I don't think I truly understood the movie until I was able to watch it at home with subtitles. And for a man who's so badly emphasizes the importance of the theatrical experience, the fact that I couldn't truly appreciate his movie until I watched it at home, I feel like means that there is a flaw in there.
He does, as part of his mystique though, is he goes for that naturalistic audio.
And that's fine. But yeah. I mean, no one means to put a flaw in their movie. No one goes out of their way to add little, you know, missteps in there. I just, and again, I'm putting it in a B category and I'm putting it in, and look, I really do like Tenet. I feel like I have sort of a love, like I go through waves with it. Like, and maybe I'm just on a downslope right now. And look, I feel it. But you know what? The fact that I can understand and feel the rest of his movies shows me that it's possible. And if it's possible, then he should have done it with this one.
Yeah, I didn't have that experience.
Like we make a lot of excuses for Tenet.
The best way I could equate Tenet is like if you've been bowling your whole life with things on the with barriers on the bowling lane. And Chris Nolan was just like, take those off and just go along for the ride with the ball and you have no idea where it's going to go. And I genuinely believe that like if you follow that line, don't try to understand it, feel it, that line. And you just let the film be. And like, I feel like at the end of the day, we're trying too hard to figure out the movie while we're watching it. Well, and I think he's just saying, let it take over.
I don't know. You said it like it's a bad thing. I think most people would call that understanding what the hell is going on.
Well, let me explain. Let me add one quick thing, though. I don't think I've ever levitated out of my chair the way I did when it came back around to realize that the fight that he had in the hallway.
If I had to put a list together of like top 10 Nolan moments.
Yeah, yeah.
Him coming back around and realizing who he was fighting at the beginning of the film would be in top 10.
Amazing.
Sick. That movie is so insane.
Lifted out of my chair.
I feel like I'm trying to convince you guys that it's bad, and that's not what I'm doing at all. It's just that it doesn't work for me on an A level the way that the rest of his movies do.
I think that puts us at an A. We're reaching towards the end here, so I want to
look at this A level.
It's a lot of A's. Kev, I think you officially A. Sean officially A. Me officially A. Jake officially high B. Yep. Oppenheimer is going to be, I think, in contention for our masterpiece.
It's an A.
So yeah, A. If we can go ahead and throw this in A, throw to a quick break, we'll come out, decide our masterpiece, and close this out.
Let's do it.
Everybody in A?
Yes.
Yep. Well, we'll talk more Oppenheimer, I think, when we get to masterpiece. But
to know.
We're dropping it in A, and we will be right back. We'll be right back to decide which of these most of his films are his actual masterpiece. Jesus. That are now in the A category.
God help us. Three B's.
All right, we are back, and now we are tasked with deciding which of his films are his masterpiece. The way that this works, as I mentioned in the beginning, is we're going to take the entire A category, A tier. And we'll go around and just sort of get a temperature check. I like to say it is like, you know, we each kind of elect one of where we're at, and then we try to come to some sort of conclusion. I'd like to kick us off because I have an interesting thought, and I just want to get your guys' thought on that. And that I think you could make an argument that Oppenheimer is a masterpiece and Tenet is Christopher Nolan's masterpiece.
Interesting.
And I say that because I think Tenet is the culmination of what Christopher Nolan does in films. Playing with time, playing with your headspace, playing with your understanding of what's happening in front of you. I know you don't like this film in the same way, but I see it as a masterpiece in that it is Christopher Nolan, whereas Oppenheimer I put as a masterpiece of like, I think it's the best thing he's made as far as like a film is concerned. But Tenet is more his stamp on what film like what film can be. And that's the weird headspace I'm in of like, what do I mean by a Christopher Nolan quote unquote masterpiece? But I'm curious your guys' thoughts.
We're going to have four different S's, aren't we?
We might.
I don't know.
So mine is Oppenheimer because, and Gabe, I understand what you're saying, but I also think that Oppenheimer plays with the alternating timelines and stories that seem like they shouldn't sync up, but he figures out how to make them sync up. Either it's thematically or emotionally, you're watching different time periods, completely different time periods and developments of character stories. And he finds a way for them to gel so perfectly in Oppenheimer. And when it comes back around to this conversation between Einstein and Oppenheimer, you know, that essentially is the stamp that hangs over the entire movie. That to me was such a flawless, just like, so I have to go with Oppenheimer. I truly, truly believe that Oppenheimer is the movie that he had been building toward his entire time.
And I don't disagree. I don't disagree. Like I that's why I said I'm on the fence of like, I could see if I was making the argument of who the prestige, Inception, Interstellar, Memento filmmaker is, is the culmination is Tenet. But I think Oppenheimer, I'm happy to make that his masterpiece.
I also just think across the board, I think that cast gives uniformly some of the best performances in a Nolan film.
Yeah.
And I just think I think the screenplay is something truly different.
Yeah.
I think the screenplay is truly, truly unique and perfect.
Jake or Kevin, who has something to nominate or confirm with Oppenheimer? I think that's what we have on the board so far.
I mean, Oppenheimer is kind of what I thought everyone was going to, is what, if I had to put money down before we start recording this episode, it's the one that I figured we would all at least universally agree, like without killing each other. If it were just me making this list, I have to throw in an X factor of just the joyous feeling that I had when a movie cut to black, and the way that a movie defined my personality and who I was as a movie fan in the wake of its release. And for me, that's Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. It was a seminal movie in both my sort of journey as a film fan and a journey of my understanding of what film could be. And even just, it was early in my career. I got to cover The Junket, which was really cool. So that was a sort of a big moment of like really trying to like understand things and look at things from a different level. And it is probably the greatest theatrical experience of my life. I've never, seeing that, at IMAX in LA and just getting on the phone and just making the rounds that night of calling my buddies and telling them about this experience that was coming. I attended, because Warner Brothers clearly knew what they had and screened the hell out of it. I think I attended 6 different press screenings of the movie before it ever actually came out. Jeez. It's the most. I think I saw it 2 more times once it came out. Not quite Kev levels, but it's the
most
for me.
That's at my level, yeah, dude.
It's the most I've ever seen a movie in theaters. It's the movie of his that I've watched. And I also just think from an absolute technical level, it's marvelous. I think it's some of
or
his
DC,
most...
DC.
Yeah, delicious. Well done.
Delicious. Batman Begins has a better ending.
No, I think I strongly disagree. Well, but no. To me, when I take the ending as like the final sequence, like to me, Batman losing is the epitome of Batman.
Oh, it's the
like
best.
Like Batman accepting like I have to become the villain because that's what saves Gotham. To me, that is the greatest Batman like moment.
Kev?
Like that. Really quick. I think the my favorite Nolan sequence ever is the interrogation between Jim Gordon and Joker, and then Batman and Joker, where it's just, well, was it Wally Pfister? All he just lights it with a light bulb. That's my favorite Christopher Nolan sequence ever.
Oh, Kev, curious what you would nominate from this list of A's.
I mean, I got goosebumps hearing what Jake was saying just now about Dark Knight, because it is the greatest theatrical experience I've ever experienced as well. I mean,
I think it's in the running for sure.
A lot of that had to do with, for me at least, was the technical nature of that film. I remember, the 70mm IMAX experience, seeing that for the first time was everything. It changed my entire perspective on the way movies can immerse you in a theater. Never seen anything feature storytelling on that level. But I also remember being obsessed with the Blu-ray, because when they released that film on DVD, Chris Nolan, he did these incredible special features, especially the truck flip. I learned who this incredible stuntman named Jim Wilkie is, who's the guy who flies the plane drives the plane into the hangar in Tenet. And I mean, just incredible. And so I can't disagree with Jake on that. I do think I'm having a Tarantino situation here where I think Oppenheimer is the best movie that Nolan's ever made.
I wouldn't be mad if we chose. There are some movies in our A category that I would be annoyed if we chose it
as the
masterpiece.
I think there are agents that have
I wouldn't be mad if we chose Oppenheimer.
We have two Oppenheimers and two Dark Knights right now.
Well Kev, are you Dark Knight or are you still unsure?
Well, so it's interesting.
I would have thought you would have said Interstellar, if I'm being honest with you.
He's not done yet.
Well, no. Jake's not wrong. So, Dark Knight. What Jake just said about Dark Knight is exactly how I feel about that film. So, I can't disagree with him on that. Interstellar is my favorite Christopher Nolan movie of all time. Sure. So, if you look at Quentin Tarantino, my favorite Tarantino movie is Pulp Fiction. But I think Hollywood is the best movie he's ever made.
Right. And it's very similar in that, like, Hollywood is it feels different than all of his movies.
That's interesting.
I mean?
That's an interesting comparison. Pulp Fiction and Hollywood to Dark Knight and Oppenheimer.
And I think Oppenheimer is the best movie he's ever made, because I mean, I saw it 10 times in theaters. Obviously, it was a 3-hour R-rated biopic that made almost $1 billion. Mm-hmm. I don't think that money factors in here, but to me, Oppenheimer was an experience.
Just to highlight that point, I think money factors in, particularly with Nolan, but I think that gives you a clue into sort of the general audience's response to a film and it working on many levels and working as a film on its own in that moment. Like the fact that it was able to capture a moment and be a part of the zeitgeist and be a part of the conversation across film fans, I think is important because it hits such a scale.
Yeah, and also the fact that like you tell me Dark Knight makes $1 billion, and I go, sure, okay, yeah. But you tell me Oppenheimer makes $1 billion,
and say, yes.
Now we're having a conversation. So I do agree. Yeah, I do agree. Where you should never use money as a judge. But there are some moments where you can use money as a judge.
Yeah. It tells you something. It's a physicist.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is his masterpiece, but it's weird because The Dark Knight is so pivotal to where we are in cinema now.
But that's not changing.
I know. And if we like Gabe said at the beginning of the show, this really comes down to whether or not you believe in the actual definition of the word masterpiece. Because I have always been of mind that a filmmaker can have multiple, but the definition of masterpiece is
the word has changed. The word literally doesn't mean literally anymore. Like the word changes.
But like, theoretically, this is for fun to put one at the top.
Yeah. But Dark Knight.
Because I agree. I think that Oppenheimer, though, is really, even in the traditional sense, a masterpiece in that I don't think Christopher Nolan could make this movie until he made all these other films and was able to work at this scale and then create a script. If you can create. And again, Tenet has its, and maybe Inception, they have their issues of the audience understanding it or this, that, and the other. I made the argument that I think everything you need is in the film. But if you can go to the headspace of making Tenet's sort of storylines connect in the way that it does and make the Inception thing and write out the way that the dream structure works, and you can structure a story, let's just say story structure in that way. I think that all of that is an exercise in being able to make...
Yeah.
Oppenheimer in as tight as it is.
And you bring up the script and this, I know we got to go. The Oppenheimer script. I don't think people talk about it enough. I know the Oscars, I understand it was the discussion, but
it should have won screenplay.
Yeah.
Right. And to write a script that is dealing with first person in color.
Has there been a better script this decade?
And black and white and subjective. First person was color and black and white was third person. No, I think it's one of the greatest scripts ever written.
The Finch script?
Yeah, yeah. But no, Oppenheimer is one of the greatest movies
ever
made. Yeah.
No, it is a masterpiece. To this point, and with Tarantino and with Nolan, whatever they do after this, we're going to immediately compare it to Hollywood and Oppenheimer. That's the bar, right?
I think Nolan needs to make a movie about a guy stuck in a cabin. You know what I mean? Like we just need a small, like you just see the trailer and you're like, okay, I can't put too much on this because it's a small, tiny movie. It can't be Oppenheimer's.
I don't know how he does it.
But I don't think he's
going to. I don't know what he does next.
I don't know. I'm in. Well, that'll have it. For the audio listeners at home, you can hop on YouTube. We have a visual aid up to see it. We have The Dark Knight Rises, Insomnia, and Following, and B. In A, we have Memento, Batman Begins, The Prestige, The Dark Knight, Inception, Dunkirk, Interstellar, and Tenet, and his masterpiece above the rest, for the sake of this argument and for fun, is Oppenheimer. And
well
I'm
done,
very
boys.
Happy with that. I'm very happy with that list.
Well done.
Well done, boys. All right. That is our show this week, but I will let Sean sign us off.
It's up to you. Head to the comments and let us know what you think Christopher Nolan's masterpiece is. Do you agree with us that it is Oppie? Do you think it's something else that he has done over the course of his career? We want to hear what you guys have to say in the comments down below. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode as we get closer to the Toronto Film Festival and Beetlejuice and a bunch of other things coming in September. Gonna start getting busy around here again real soon. So
wait, Sean, what's the name of that Tim Burton movie?
Beetlejuice.
Wait, one more time?
No, I won't say it three times.
You did say it three times, Zach, technically speaking, because you said it once. Then you said it twice. I'm trying to get you to say it three times.
I watched your Winona interview. I know she's superstitious. I'm superstitious. Dude, I know we have to run. I know we have to go. But Catherine O'Hara saying Kevin to you.
Dude.
Blew my mind.
Dude, it was it wasn't prompted. We had talked about the name two questions prior, and then I'm saying goodbye, and she goes, "May I?" And I'm like, "May you what?"
What? That's the most insane thing ever.
I can't believe it was on camera. I thought I was surprised they didn't cut the cameras.
Yeah. Go watch Kevin's interview on behalf of Beetlejuice. Okay, follow us on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean _O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. We'll talk to you guys next week. Dunkirk!
Aww.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.